Our guest speaker this morning is Monica Kirke. Years ago, she and her large family were refugees from Ceausescu's Romania. Monica will share her own refugee story and those of others to help us better understand the suffering and the struggles of these people as they undertake to rebuild their lives. Ms. Kirke is the founder of Pax Manifesto, a peace-building organization that utilizes technology, communications, and grassroots movements to build peace. She holds dual master's degrees from Brandeis University's Heller School of Management and Policy in Sustainable International Development and Conflict and Coexistence. Monica lives in Orange County with her husband and two little future peace builders.
Wow. I hope I do not disappoint. My name is Monica. I recognize Debbie. Hi, Debbie. I was organizing with OCO, the Orange County Congregation Community Organization, where I had the chance to work with Debbie for a few things. I think they've come here and spoken on immigration and other issues. I was doing restorative justice organizing, and I had a chance to speak at Tapestry about that. And so to me, I see a lot of this interconnected with peace building and how we make a world that's just and fair for everyone. When we came to America, my grandparents actually came before us, and they had been through World War I, World War II. They're both deceased now, but they both lived till 97. They came in 78, and 10 years ago, they were living in Montebello in an assisted living facility, and I went to go visit them, as I did once a week. And we have 11 brothers and sisters, so a lot of us would always come there. It's different than when we were children. My grandma used to say, like, we're happy to see you twice, when you come and when you go. So they got two joys out of us because so many kids. I just remember one time when we were going around, so it's like it's a circle building in Montebello, and we went around, kind of did a walk around for exercise for them. That was pretty much good exercise. And my grandma was getting a little more elderly. My grandfather is very creative, so he had a wheelchair. And he tied a red rope to the end of the wheelchair, and then he would drag the wheelchair, and my grandma would hold the wheelchair, and he would drag it. So essentially, he was doing a walker, but he would drag her. And as he was, pulling her, and she was carrying it, he told me the story of how she plowed the fields, right? And how she was such a woman of dignity, and how she provided for the family. And this is the story that he would tell. During a pretty indignified time, right, getting pulled by somebody around an assisted living home, right? And that to me is kind of the picture of the refugee experience of how do we get that dignity restored? How do we, I call it like returning to ourselves. How do we return to ourselves? Because so much is lost. And all of us have lost something. All of us need to be restored or redeemed. Maybe there's been many lost years due to depression or sorrow or lost loved ones, maybe a house burned down. There's so many losses in our lives, and we find little things to restore ourselves. I come from the Christian tradition, and Joel 2:25 is one of my favorite verses when I think about restoration. It says, so I will restore you to the years that the swarming locusts have eaten, the crawling locusts, the consuming locusts. That those years would be returned to the people of Israel. That they're not going to be lost forever. And then the second half it said, you shall eat plenty and be satisfied and praise to the name of the Lord. And I will be in the midst of Israel. Your sons and daughters will prophesy, and the old men shall dream dreams, and the young men shall see visions. And that's our hope for refugees today. And that was our hope coming to a new land, is that those years would be restored. Maybe differently, but they would definitely be restored. So I'm one of 11. I'm the youngest girl. We have 7 brothers and four girls. And my parents were very active in Romania as a political activist, but also as they worked in the underground church. In Romania, you couldn't have any faith. The state was the faith. And so there was persecution against Jehovah's Witnesses and Zoroastrian, any faith that you decided to practice was persecuted. And Christians, they have a text, as Muslims have a text. There wasn't very many Muslims, but so the holy text is kind of a symbol of your faith. And so if you have that, it shows that you're active in the faith. And so having the text and other censored books was an act of treason against the state. And so my father was part of the, involved in the underground church where they would transport books and Bibles and even, words, you know, content like, sermons or speeches. VOA, you know, Voice of America was very, you know, on the down. You couldn't really, listen to that. And so they were so creative in how they managed this kind of resistance, acts of resistance, but they paid dearly. So some of the things they did was there was so all of our phones were tapped, everything was tapped. There was secret police out in front of our house because my dad was not only a leader, he actually did the worst act of treason. He educated children in it. And so you're not supposed to educate children. Children are wards of the state. And so you shouldn't educate. So my father was a mentor and kind of a father figure to a lot of the young men within the community that was Christian. So we had the secret police in front of our house. And so when my brothers would go to school, my dad would carry all of their books, and their backpacks would be filled with censored books. And so they would walk out with their school books, and my brothers would basically be the transporters of censored material. And so then the phones were tapped, so they would, if somebody calls you and they'd say like, alo, akuma, like everything starts with an A, if that's hello, right now, we're going, if everything starts with an A, that means that the shipment is at the port A. And you need to go to port A, or if you do it B. And also another thing, my father, many people in that movement have two names. They have the name within the community and the name outside the community. So my dad, his name is Constantin, is his given name by the state, by his mother, and the state recognizes it. But his secret name is Joren. And so when torture happened, which happened often, when they were taken and they were tortured and tried to get information extracted, we said that the walls have ears, so you couldn't, you know, you don't want to speak to anybody. My husband still whispers his social security number in Romanian in our house here. We're in America. You don't have to whisper anymore. But it's really inculcated in you that somebody's listening somewhere. But when that did happen, you know, there was a lot of pain in that, and there was a lot of years taken away. We have a family friend that was incarcerated for 28 years because of that. And tortured, beaten on their feet, and on his back is full of, so there was many people that really suffered, For freedom. So my mom was a hustler, as her mother was before her. My grandmother, the same one that was plowing, she would knit hats, and they would go to the country, to the resort areas, and she would sell them, you know, kind of in a shadow economy, just selling them on the street. But she was smart, because she would bring my four oldest brothers. So the police didn't want to arrest her, because then they'd have four kids to take care of. So they just let her do her business, and then she would, so they were again like human shields. From police arresting her, so this kind of creativity was necessary in this environment. So my mom has the same creativity, and I think she passed it on to all of us. It's entrepreneur spirit. She sat us all at a table, and we had bowls that were all empty, and she took pictures and she printed, I think, like 300-500 pictures. We still brought them. I don't know why we brought them to America, but she has a ton of them. And every day she would take all of us kids and go to the Secret Services, the Communist Party's office, and give them the picture and say, we have no food, we're suffering, let us go out, let us leave Romania. At that time, the Jimmy Carter Family Reunification Act was passed here, so we can actually come because my uncle and grandparents were already here. But Romania didn't let us go because, you might not know, it was the best country in the world, and why would you want to leave? So everyone was not allowed to leave. If you left, you know, you would leave... much like maybe Mexicans leave now, you would literally cross the border, jump the border into Austria, into Hungary and then into Austria. So there was, the only way to leave legally was through the visa process, that was very rare. They weren't giving very many out. So, after 2 years of this, of going every day and bringing a photograph to the secret police, they finally like, get out of here, woman. And they let us leave. And so 11 of us got on an airplane, 12, 13 of us, I should say, my grandparents, my parents and all of us, and we flew from Romania to a refugee transit camp in Rome, and we stayed in Rome for about a month, 2 months, and then we came to Los Angeles. So we resettled here in Los Angeles in 1981. I was just 5. I don't remember anything before that. I remember the first few weeks here. So if you think about that trauma of what, you know, what would make me forget everything except the first weeks here, that's pretty typical and normal of many refugees. A lot of trauma, a lot of pain. My parents were nurses. When they got here, they had to study English first, and then they had to pass their boards, and they were CNAs. So they were like almost doctors in Romania, and they came here and they became CNAs, which is, you know, the very entry-level nurse position. And they had to do that for a long time before they actually passed the boards and were able to become what they were already. So you could say those are lost years, right? And lost years of dignity. My father was a nurse, and he came here and he cleaned the church that we lived, that we were going to. He was the janitor. He was treated really bad because of his accent, because I think people just felt like they could treat him bad. I'm not sure why, but as a young kid, I didn't know why. But I do remember the pain and the anger I would feel when his dignity was taken away, when I would see people treat him bad. And this is often the experience of many refugees that have come, and they were people that are pretty dignified back at home, and they come here and don't have much to show for themselves. My father was is a very amazing person. He taught us through example also just how to dignify others. I remember one time we were able to get a house through, you know, through actually exaggerating some funds that my aunt had. So a lot of, you know, there's a lot of, the laws do not work for immigrants. The laws do not work for refugees. And so there needs to be some stretching of truth a lot of times. And I'll talk more about that, about the housing crisis here in Orange County with refugees. But we were able to get a house from my aunt. So my aunt put money in our bank, and then we said it was ours. So it wasn't a huge, you know, lie, but it wasn't our money, that's for sure, right? But we were blessed to have a house with 11 kids, and the roof was gone. It was like a drug house, I think, so it was very cheap. It was like $100,000 in 1985, right? So it was very, very cheap. It was pretty run down in Garden Grove, but we had to get the roof done. So some Mexican workers came, and they were fixing the roof, and my dad, he went in the kitchen. He prepared them a sprawling lunch, and he went and climbed to the roof, and he fed them. So he was trying to restore back to them, right? So how do we restore back to people what they lost? And that's what I feel like the refugee work that I'm doing now is what it's doing. It's just we're restoring back. We're just forgiving from what we have because we have plenty and giving back to people that get trying. So it's not just material goods. It's also even our inner resources, right? It could be our love and care. So just want to tell you a little bit about the refugee situation here. I'll be afterwards. We can talk more statistics and numbers, and you know, I just want to talk more about stories and who comes and why they're coming, if that's okay. So right now in the world we have a shift, a big shift in the last, I would say, 10, 15 years, and you could call it like the difference between old wars and new wars. Old wars, you have military against military. New wars, you have mercenary groups, you have wars happening in very urban environments, you have environmental natural resources that are the sources of wars, so you have people that are victims but also implicated in the conflicts. So things are a lot more complicated than before when it was just two armies against each other. This has caused an influx in not only internally displaced people, but also externally, you know, refugees. IDPs are very many, but just refugees, there's over 60 million right now in the world. Just refugees. That's insane. That's the most that we've ever had. We can count what's happened in Congo, and a lot of the mineral war, the war around natural resources and minerals, an extension of colonialism. Many have died there, and many have left. Orange County, we do see few. We have about 5, 10, 15 every year that come from Congo because of that war. Or Uganda, or somewhere in the Great Lakes area that has become a victim of the natural resource war. Many of them go to Europe. But, you know, Europe is seeing a lot more. We have Afghanistan, our occupation. our presence there, but also just a lot of the internal politics there have caused a lot of the war. Many of the Afghans that come here are actually SIVs. They're called Special Immigrant Visa Holders, and they worked with the U.S. government. So they were collaborators with the U.S. government, and now their lives are really, you know, at stake. So they need to leave because they're not safe in their country. So they're a different kind of refugee. They have more funds, right? They were paid pretty well. And so they have to pay their own way, but they do get a visa. So it's like, we have a green card for you. You just have to fly over here and get it. So we're seeing that. We're seeing big families. We're seeing, you know, a year and a half ago, 17 people from two families came. They pay their own way, but they have nothing. Once they come here, they spent all their money, and now they're done, right? So they need a lot of support, but they have a different status. They're highly educated. They can start work soon. And then we have, of course, Syrian, right? Syria is a war that's been going on for 5 years now. In 2012, when the war just was 1 year, going, I was in Gaziantep, in Turkey, that's the city right next to Aleppo, and I was able to train Syrian activists. And I worked for 2 weeks with them in, is that me? Okay. I worked for 2 weeks training them in humanitarian response and conflict coexistence, how to have a conflict-sensitive approach to humanitarian aid and to giving. Sometimes we say, though, that's a soldier. He's not worthy of my food. That's a person on my side. They are. But in peace building, we want to make sure that we don't evaluate based on, you know, who you are or what. But you meet the humanitarian. You meet the current need. So I was able to train that. And I just remember the hope and the aspirations that they had at that time, and it's really changed since then. A few of the activists that I train are actually in Southern California. One lives in Diamond Bar, and they left because there's just no more hope. And these are people that are going to die for the cause. You know, they were, and so right now the many people stayed close by, right, in Zaatari camp, and because they really hoped that the dynamics would change in Syria. And so this influx of refugees, right? Why didn't it happen 2 years ago, 3 years ago into Europe? What's changed, right? I mean, that's some people ask, right? It's been going on for 5 years. This influx is that I think a lot of, there's no more hope that there's going to be a difference in the long run. And so people are really, you know, I think they've been through the different stages of loss. And now they're just like, okay, we need to do something. We need to restore that for ourselves because nobody's handing us this restoration. And so just like activists that are so involved in the cause are just leaving, the same thing has happened with refugees who were trying to stay as close to their homeland as possible so they could just cross the border and go back. Now they're, you know, going to Germany and applying to come here. We only have had very small amounts. In the United States, about 2,500 Syrian refugees have come, which is nothing. We heard from the State Department that they were trying to get 10,000. Approved Loretta Sanchez, who is on the Foreign Relations Committee. She also supports that. But it's politics. It could change tomorrow, especially if Donald Trump becomes president. It could definitely change. And this rhetoric drives politics. It does. Over 31 states have said that they will not accept Syrian refugees. Okay. You know, these are people that have lived outside their country for 5 years. This is the refugee process. It takes about 18 to 24 months. People apply with UNHCR and they the UN agency, and they apply, and then the UN agency actually refers them to one of the 9 resettlement agencies that are in the United States. Then they have to go through biometrics, they have to go through vetting, they have to go through many, many processes. By the time that's over, they have to do it all over again. Because they have to do the biometrics all over again because so much time has passed. And now they might be sick. And the quality in the camps are not the best. So they're the most vetted individuals that will ever come into the United States. And yet the ideology and the language against them is so wrong because it's just not accurate. But we only have about 2,500 here. They do have certain needs that others don't, and I think that's where what we're working in. We're working on a guidebook. It's called the Refugees Welcome Guidebook. Myself and Rashad, he's the director of the Arab American Civic Council, And we had an idea of, it has two parts. It's about social cohesion. So not only restoring, but how do we create a society where that's welcoming and embracing of people? And that takes two things. That takes a lot of effort from the bottom, right? So that takes refugees to feel like they can integrate. It takes education, access to information, to resources, housing. It takes them to be able to settle wherever they are, whether it's here or somewhere else. So the social cohesion has that, but then it has the bigger part of the narrative. You know, do we accept them? You know, would we hire a refugee? Would we want them to live in our apartment complex? Would we want them to live near be our neighbors? So those are the two aspects of this guidebook. So we have the narrative and then the actual information and resources. So we're creating a physical guidebook that is going to be printed, an app and a website that helps. And it's, by the way, it's funded by the Unitarian Universal Service Committee. So your national and international foundation, where money is given out, has decided this is a project to fund. And that didn't, I don't know if Jim knew that or anything, but it's something that is really, we met last week with Pamela and Evan, and it's just, we're really on the same page. It's just a beautiful partnership, because they have such a good vision for this, for not only helping people resettle, like in real, you know, doing tutoring and housing, and there's people in the congregation I know that house refugees. I mean, that shows that you're very committed to the cause, but also just even for the narrative, for the policy, you know, can we create a country that is accepting and welcoming of refugees through policy or through narrative? So the project is one aspect of a big effort to welcome refugees. In Orange County, we welcome about 600 a year. That's all, 600 a year. Okay. From all of Orange County. Oh, all over the world, yep. Yeah, and I have the specific numbers if you want. I can definitely share those. But we mostly have, if that's your question, we mostly have from Afghan SIVs. We have, so they're not refugees. They need refugee services, but they are not refugees when they come. Syrian, a very small amount. We have Iraq. Most of ours are from Iraq because of the war in Iraq. So many of them coming now are from Iraq because what happened 3 years ago. You know, who was applying 3 years ago? You know, Iraqis. So that's what's going to come now. So in 2 years, maybe in a year and a half, we'll see more Syrians. They do want to expedite the Syrian process so that more can come. There's a hope that over 100,000 Syrians can be resettled in the United States, which is nothing. I mean, in all of California, you'll be surprised how few refugees are resettled. In all of California, 5,000. In all of California, we have probably the best economies of many parts of the country, right, where we can really take in some, and they're educated people, or they're people that are hardworking, and somebody that they, not only that, they need a lot of help. We need to do that. Canada's making us look bad with, you know, accepting 70,000, and I think we can do a lot better. So that's really, in Southern California accepts about 2,000, and by that I mean LA, Inland Empire, and Orange County. Just San Diego accepts 2,000. So we're really not doing as much as we could do. We really are not. And at this point we have about, there's five refugee resettlement agencies in Southern California. So the three county, or four county, Riverside and San Bernardino. And they're bringing in refugees, maybe once, twice a month, a family. And the process is such where there's a case manager at either it's IRC or IRIS or World Relief, and they bring them and they come, they pick them up from the airport and they come. And then within the first 10 days, for the first 2 days, there's something that refugees have to do. They have to get their Social Security card. They have to get their SNAP, their food stamp, and then they can get their cash assistance. When a refugee comes, in the past, it was 18 months of support. And then it became 12 months, and now it's 8 months, but really only 3 months of cash support. In Germany, you'll have 2 years where you can learn English, you can have housing, you have support to really integrate, that you can get this funding. We have 3 months. Okay, that's what our State Department gives. And how it works is the State Department gives money to the states, and then the states hand it to the counties. So that's why 31 states can say they don't want the money. And that's how it happened. They just say, we don't want your money, your Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR money. And then the states and the counties have their own funding also that they also put in. So for refugees, they come and the resettlement agency helps them access those. But many, many social security offices, social service offices don't know what refugees need. They don't know that they get this much cash assistance. And we have a family that 3 months ago they came from Syria, from Jordan, from Zaatari camp. And they went to social services, just happened last week. And they said, no, you don't get that money. And they're like, yes, we do. No, you don't. And so the advocacy part, just really accompaniment and advocacy at those points is very important, because they'll be taken advantage of by people that don't even know they're taking advantage of them, because they don't even know the process. So the guidebook is not only just giving them information, but also helping direct them to social security offices or to DMVs or to places that people know how to help refugees, because it is a different population. So that's why it's so needed. Often they fall through the cracks and there's not a lot of help. So when they come, they don't have credit, right? Because how would you acquire credit in Zaatari camp? But that does not, fly with a lot of apartment owners. So we have a huge housing crisis. And I'm not kidding. I go to every resettlement agency, in LA and Orange County, every service provider. Oh, good guidebook. So are you going to solve the housing crisis? How is a guidebook going to solve your housing crisis? That seems like a policy issue. That seems like a housing, like a relational issue with apartment owners. So there's a big problem where they don't have anywhere to live. They really don't have anyone to stay because they need credit, or they need people to vouch for them. I know the Mar Vista Unitarian Universalist, they're helping three families now. And so that's with tutoring. That's in Claremont, I think, Montclair or Claremont. Anyway, it's up the 60 there. But they're doing, they're helping the three families. They came to the congregation. And so with tutoring, they need English language. There is free tutoring, the free English language classes. So helping them get access to that, to know where it is. But a lot of times, if it's a mother, it's hard for her to get out of the house, to be able to go to class. There's no car. One family that lives in Azusa, the father, they don't have a car. He rides his bike 23 miles every, one way to go to work and back. They've been here 3 months. So I don't think anybody can say this is not people that are trying. It's really impossible. It's really difficult. That UU church was able to do a fundraiser. They provided $10,000 for another family to get a good car. It was a seven-member family. So that's the kind of support that other churches are doing, in that really tangible ways, but also just supporting with welcoming, with restoring all of that. I don't know how I'm doing on time, because how's it going? Okay, all right. Yeah. I can perhaps take some questions about the process, or how we can work. Is that okay now, or after? Yeah, I think.
Offertory, and then we can bring you back.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Yeah, so just in closing, I would say that the refugee resettlement agencies here, World Relief, that's in Garden Grove, they have a program for volunteers, and they could use support. But even the IRC in Glendale, they mostly resettle. I can tell you where different refugees live in Southern California. So IRC brings in Armenians from Iran. So a lot of Iranians, whether they be Armenian or Zoroastrian or Baha'i, there's a lot of religious persecution, similar to how we came here. Where you cannot be another faith besides being Muslim. Or you can't convert, really. So the issue is, if you convert from Islam, then you go. So if you're born Jewish, then that's much more acceptable. Zoroastrian, Baha'i, that's usually newer faith or Christianity, and so it's a conversion process. So a lot of them suffer a lot of persecution, and so they've been coming to, and so they've mostly resettled to Glendale or West LA. In Orange County, we see more Iraqis. And then you have Little Arabia that has formed because of that. So Little Arabia, if you go down on Brookhurst, Between the 5 freeway and the 22, and just the different the streets around, you'll have lots of sprawling Arabic-speaking population in West Anaheim. And that's come from a lot of the refugees that have resettled here from Iraq and Syria. And so that's the communities have been built, and they're trying to really become more tight-knit. And that's another way we could support is by, you know, patronizing those businesses. There's an Alipost kitchen that's amazing food. And he actually was a U.S. citizen. He went back to invest in his country. He had a restaurant there. And because of the war, he came back. So when we talk about refugees, we really do talk about small r. I'm not talking about only the ones that I mentioned before, that the 5,000 in California, because there really is a bigger issue of people fleeing conflict that are not recognized by our state, right? So we have Central American unaccompanied minors, and that's a really big issue. The state is really is trying, by the way. There is a small provision to include them as refugees, the youth. And so that's become something that we're working on to help the unaccompanied minors receive, legal access, legal status here, but to be able to live here and to be safe here without being called, you know, illegal or undocumented. So that's a big issue with unaccompanied minors. And then we have in Orange County, we had a big population of Vietnamese refugees, and that made Little Saigon. So from 1979 till today, World Relief has brought over more than 35,000 Vietnamese refugees. So that can kind of tell you how our demographics have really shifted because of refugees. So traditionally, we have been a very welcoming county. I think politics and how things have happened have stopped that. We could definitely become that again. So the main takeaway, I would say, is there's refugees all around, whether they be undocumented immigrants or they have legal status here. Many, 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 many are amnesty seekers. There's many Syrians here that are not part of those 2,500. And they're just there seeking amnesty. And so getting in touch with them, serving them, seeing how to support them, even with English language. Even there's the mother in the Inland Empire for the Weiwei family. She knows how to knit. And so they were thinking maybe teaching her a little bit of social entrepreneurship or being able to sell her things on Etsy or something and I'm sure there's some here that might know anything about that, you know. So it's really just being creative and supportive, but really reaching out in a loving way. But thank you so much for the opportunity to share today.
Representing Orange County and your work is here. But I would like your opinion of what's happening with Turkey trying to enter the EU and with the proviso that it will take more refugees.
Yeah, I am not a geopolitical expert on Turkey, but I'm Romania in the similar, in 2007 became part of the EU, as did Greece and Bulgaria, and I think EU is kind of done taking countries that doesn't feel like they are at the social economic level that is going to contribute to the EU. So that is a big barrier. I think they're trying to get Turkey as a second class, like second tier part of the EU. But there was a lot of regret, I think, from the EU that I understand from accepting Romania or Bulgaria or other countries that didn't. They basically became migratory countries. And so, you know, many of our friends in Romania are in England or Spain now because they just were able to travel there. So they're like, so instead of refugees or undocumented immigrants, they were legally able to go and they just migrated. So I think there's a fear that Turkey's going to do the same thing. Yeah. And anyways, Germany's taken so many. And, you know, I don't think they feel, UK is not taking them, but I don't think they feel any guilt of, like, not taking any refugees. They're taking quite a lot, too, Western Europe, you know, so that's not, I don't know if that's any kind of solace in, like, accepting them, because they're taking a lot.
Hi. I have two questions. First one, just clarification. You said something about the assistance that they're provided. Initially it was 18 months, and now it's So do you mean like from the time that they come here, they have basically like 3 months to become independent and on their own?
Yeah. They have to like work, so they have to find a job. They have to go to English classes, and they get each refugee gets I think 1,300 the minute like when they get here. So if you have seven kids, that's great, right? You get some money, you can put a down payment on the house. If you're three people, then you only have, you know, less than $4,000. So that really, yeah, that's it. And then they
think of like someone like me who's had every opportunity and how long I depended on my own parents coming out of college to see it settle. Like, it's hard to believe that someone in their situation, most family, has 3 months to figure it out in a place that they've never.
Yeah, no, it's insane. I mean, it really, and we're not even talking about the psychosocial, you know, the trauma and nightmares and, you know, the kids having nightmares and not being able to sleep, but then you have to wake up to go to English classes and go to school and take your kids to school and on a bike and, you know, it's really crazy. I personally, I know because I actually did this with a family, Iraqi family in 2007. So there was a mother and two daughters. And I just had like a three-month-old son, and you know, I was carrying him, and we went from Social Security office to DMV to, it was every day, to the doctor, and nobody was sick necessarily. It's just they have to get their biometrics. You know, are they sick again? So once they come, they have to go through all that vetting again. It wasn't like that was over. And so how are you supposed to get a job when you're literally going to appointments all day long, and then you have to go to get the English classes, and it's. Yeah, it's really insane. Service providers. There's a refugee forum of Orange County. If you're really interested in like talking to different ones, and if that, you know, that is very upsetting, and I think there's some that want to change that. It's going to be a long process. And so that's what it is right now. But you're welcome to join that, and just once a month, and really hear. I mean, it's crazy.
And my second question is really quick: is there anything being done about the gap in care? The lack of education with the employees and the Social Security offices that aren't aware of what they're entitled?
Well, it's usually an advocacy. So I know that because World Relief is in Garden Grove, that even if a refugee gets resettled in Glendale, they have to come to Garden Grove and go with a case manager, or the case manager goes to Glendale. And so that's what the guidebook is kind of useful for. It's not just like, here's a list of all the DMVs in Orange County. It's, you know, this DMV knows how to deal with this. In Cyprus, there's a Social Security office where the security guard is like, welcome, and then he takes them through the whole process. And he's kind of become an advocate for refugees where he supports them because he becomes their advocate and he helps them through the process and makes it much easier. The DMV in Santa Ana, for example, if you want to apply for your ID and a driver's license, and a license plate, they make you go through five different processes. Where the one in Garden Grove, you just apply and they'll do it all for you. So you just need, you know, it's just bureaucracy. Maybe Santa Ana has way more people, so they're just like trying to, you know, kind of do a lot more of loopholes and, you know, make people kind of slow down the process, a lot more bureaucracy so that it slows down because there's so many people. But that's kind of why we need more localized, like hyper-local knowledge. But no, there's no training. And there's, like, my heart is really to even get housing, you know, get apartment owners housing owners, people that have rental property together, and educate them, bring refugees and educate them. Who are refugees? What are their aspirations? How do they plan on working? Here's a congregation or here's an individual that's going to vouch for them. You know, we're going to put the first month's, last month's, and a deposit, you know. Because right now, without credit, you can't do anything. And so I feel like policy is a good point, but really it's like relational. And like you said, training. Even our police don't have training. You know, refugees, I mean, they come and they have different. We had an Afghan family that was bathing in a pool in a hotel. I mean, it's not because they don't know what a pool. I just, you know, it's just a disconnection from what's going on. There's trauma. There's a lot of behavior that's, you know, like inexplicable. So we have to, like, be like, you cannot bathe in the pool to the family. And then we have to tell the police, like, they're refugees. They don't necessarily know the social mores, you know. So just it's really they need training, just like the police. You know, you can't beat your wife, by the way, in America, right? So we had a Burmese family where he was just acting the way he acts and was beating his wife. And he paid for it dearly. He spent a year in jail. Because domestic violence is not, you know, in a lot of countries, that's very normal behavior, how to treat your spouse. And so there's really parts that they need to learn to behave. You can't beat your kids in public. But that's what the case managers have to teach them. What we call like the good neighbors. Like good neighbor, you know, people from the community that, like I did with the Iraqi family, is take them to different places and teach them and be with them. But yeah, I lived in Egypt for 6 months. I probably did wrong things every single day as a woman there, you know? So it's like cultural is really hard to adapt to. Yeah.
Hi. My question relates to dignity, the loss of dignity. you alluded to your parents who came across, they were respecting their field, then all of a sudden they're not respecting their field. Do you see, is it unique for a refugee family, like how they find and rediscover their dignity, or is there a pattern you've seen? Is there something you see that maybe this is the quick way we can help you to rediscover your dignity?
I mean, I think community, right? The beloved community, and really being accepting and embracing and bringing them. Sometimes I've seen passive aggressive ways of getting back your dignity from refugees, and in the sense of like hoarding material goods, or being, you know, wanting to have. You know, so like, oh, I need a blow dryer, and you go buy a new blow dryer, and you bring them, and they have three others. You know? And it's kind of like trying to get back what you lost, you know, trying to, get as much. And so being there and saying, like, we have to replace that need for something else, right? So, yeah, community, besides presence, it's very, it's very difficult. And also, I would, what I like to do is often make them experts in what they are experts in. And let them hold that place, whether they speak English or not, whether they're logistically can, you know. So if they were a teacher back at home, you know, let them be that role in the community. You know, what did you teach? Economics. Okay, can we have a community, you know, maybe we could do a class here in economics. We get a translator, and you could teach us. So something where people are able to regain that through reclaiming who they, returning to themselves. They lost themselves. The experts, and that's why I was talking about the woman with knitting. You know, that's what she brings to the table in this world. She knows how to knit. She's part of a part of Syria where artisan crafts were very, like, honored, and people would come from all over Syria to buy it from them. So this was how her income was getting made. Maybe their hair, you know, coiffeur, maybe they do their hair. I know in Oka we had a community, Vicky Bravo, you know, she does hair, and so a lot of, you know, our American allies, you know, would go to her to get their hair done. She's an undocumented immigrant. To be like, you have this expertise, I want to honor that and go to you because this is your expertise. And I think community, but also giving them that space that they had before. I'm trying to find space in our community.
I don't have a specific question, but I want to say something to everybody here, you included. Lois and I went last night to the Long Beach Opera, which is having a world premiere of a contemporary opera called Fallujah. It's about how it is that people become refugees when their city becomes the target of a foreign army. In that case, the American army. And what happens to the soldiers in that army based on the experience of one man in particular. And the music is also very interesting. But I do think this is a current thing, a global thing. And I do recommend to you and everybody here that think about going to see that opera, because it's not all that often that opera is quite as relevant, shall we say, as that.
Just to follow up with that, I would say like the arts and how the arts have played a role in this. The arts were very big in the revolution, but because of hope, when hope leaves, so does our creativity. And so that's another way to restore dignity is through the arts. So we had, and maybe you've heard of like art therapy, but here in Orange County, and I can connect you with some, we have artists, painters, actors, that have come, and they've kind of tried to, you know, they try to get involved, but, you know, to tutor your kids in painting or in art, or, you know, if you have a community theater that, you know, to include them. And they, some of them speak English, actually. So I think that's another way of using the arts to heal, but definitely, and also to inform.
I have a question. I know in our congregation there has been an interest in supporting a refugee family in some way. And, you know, I've done a little bit of work trying to figure out what to do to make that happen. And I'm hoping you might have some suggestions for us. And we have many talented people in our congregation, we have ESL teachers and people who help with finding jobs and many, many talents that I think people
would
be willing to share.
So the mosque in Irvine and the mosque in Claremont have, I would call him a missions pastor. They don't have that in Islam. But literally, it's an individual that has a heart for the community and is basically just serving the community. And so he's in connection. Tarifi, his name is Mahmoud Tarifi from the Claremont one. So I just spoke with him. They're in connection with the three families that have just recently come in the last 4 months. And one family that's in Azusa just came 3 months ago, and they're not doing well. They're not doing well. And I know it's not Orange County. One thing I was just talking to Barbara about, because she said the same thing, we want somebody here, like in Fullerton. So when somebody gets relocated, again, it's a family reunification. And so there's a process where the United States, UNHCR doesn't just like throw you anywhere, you know. That's why they're not going to Oklahoma. Or, you know, why aren't they going where there's a lot more land and jobs and stuff, right? Or maybe not even jobs, but land and housing is cheaper. Because even if it's more expensive here, they need to see where is an Arab Syrian going to integrate the best. And because of the community that has sprouted around Orange County with Little Arabia, they get resettled there. So Anaheim is not very far, right? So there are many that are there and many asylum seekers that we can connect you with. Access California is a good organization. But if you are really interested, I'll connect you with everybody. But that family in Azusa, they are having really, like, not only trauma issues, but also just resettlement issues. I talked to two, there's a medical doctor that also helps them, and both of them, two different groups, were like, the Azusa family, they're really not doing good. They're not doing good. And so there's a mother, and she has a lot of trauma. You know, so even a company, just sitting and having coffee. I mean, if you go there, you're going to have an amazing meal. Okay, so you're getting a free, some great meal, and just to visit and to see how to support, even to ask how to help. But there are people that are in the community that understand our culture to be able to be liaisons. And that's very important. One thing I would recommend is if you want to help refugees, make sure you working with others that are liaisons that are already working, because so this is how I see it. Okay, you're in the middle of a war. You're barrel bombs, right? And then 3 years later you're in Southern California. From point A to point B, a lot of hustling has happened, right? right? Somehow the millions are not here and you're here. As a refugee, 2,500 in the United and you're here. So that's a certain personality trait. That's a certain type of human being that's been able to come. And like my mom, I mean, who the heck thinks let's take a picture and bring one every day with my kids? Or my grandma, let's take four kids up to the mountain resort so that I don't get a... that's just a different mentality. So that mentality will also take you to really having... you know, there's a lot of hustling that continues. And so it's important to communicate with others that are also helping so that we can help the best, right? There was one family that he was here 5 years as an asylum seeker, and finally his three children came from Syria. This just happened. I posted on Facebook. And so we did a call to support, and they were living in a hotel, and the case manager really didn't ask a lot of questions, like after 5 years, why are you living in a hotel? Why aren't you living in? And so I was going to take his family to the aquarium of the Pacific, you know, and he called like intoxicated one night, and like things kind of unraveled really fast, and we realized we didn't ask enough questions and we didn't vet him enough, and you know we need to do that. And so working with a case manager from a resettlement agency or from a service provider like Access California, that's always good. Like no, but don't try to be the hero that saves the day, because that's what happens, is that every volunteer wants to be the hero that saves the, you know, that's the savior of the refugees. And then you duplicate efforts, and we're not helping them the best. So if we work together, it takes all of us to resettle refugees. Working together is the best way. And there's people that are very involved in the process. And that's why even me and Rashad, we are very happy to support them. We're not trying to duplicate any service provider. If we could connect people, there's people that do this for a living every day, and they need people like you. So that's the beauty of it. They need people like me, but that's what they do. So let's help them how they need us and work together. Yeah, but I could totally connect you, yeah.
I think we're about out of time now. Hopefully you can join us for some coffee and further conversation. But first of all, before we close, I'd like to thank Sam Standing and Debbie Longbach for finding our speaker today. So Monica, thank you very much.
Yeah,
join me in
thank you. Can I read one quick poem that I wanted to read that I didn't? It's called Open Heart. It said, he told me that once he forgot himself, and his heart opened up like a door with a loose latch, and everything fell out, and he tried for days to put it all back in the proper order. But finally he gave up, and he left it there in a pile and loved everything equally. Thank you.